You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, not to be a downer, but there's not that much of summer left to us. So if you're still working on your summertime to-do list, you don't have a lot of time to put it off any further.
I am in that category. One of my summer goals is to clean out the basement. Whoops, not there yet. So what gets us into this position in the first place? Why do we put things off? Why do we procrastinate? And can we change our ways? Our next guest has been researching procrastination for many years now. He's looked at the causes, the consequences, and possible cures.
Joseph Ferrari joins us now. He's a professor of psychology at DePaul University and the author of the book, Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Veronica and Rob. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm glad you picked this topic. If I may start, everybody procrastinates, but not everyone is a procrastinator. You know, it's not a time management issue. It's not a question of having a to-do list and having lots to do. Because busy people have to-do lists. Why do they get things done? Why do some people, you know, there's that old expression, you want something done, give it to a busy person. Well, why? Because they value time and they value the time of others. Procrastination is not a question of time.
So if it's not, then why? Why do we procrastinate?
Well, here we go. Everybody procrastinates. What we have found in my research here at DePaul since the late 1980s, I've been studying this topic, is 20 to 25% of adult men and women, there's no sex difference, are chronic procrastinators. This is their lifestyle. Their delay doing taxes and buying Christmas gifts, cleaning out the basement, Rob, doing restocking refrigerators, waiting the gauge goes on empty before they get more gas, paying the bill when the third bill comes. Why 20 to 25% individuals? And this is not just a U.S. phenomena. I have found this in Europe, in England, in Ireland, in Poland, in Italy, in Austria, in Israel, Tel Aviv, in the Middle East. We find it in Saudi Arabia. A graduate student just finished it in Japan. I've done South America, in Spain, Peru, Venezuela. 20 to 25%. That's higher than depression. That's higher than phobia. That's higher than many other psychiatric diseases. Substance abuse, addictions. And yet we take this as a funny topic. We look at this as, well, they're lazy. Well, they're just not getting things done. And that's not true, because procrastination is not dawdling, it's not delaying, it's not waiting. Because when you're waiting and dawdling and delaying, you're probably actively working on the task. You're gathering more information in.
Right, which brings me to the question, is there anything inherently wrong with procrastination? As long as you get the job done, what's wrong with procrastinating?
Okay, recent studies have showed, not from my lab, another lab, that you're three times more likely to die of a heart attack or a stroke. Previous, there's a whole field called behavioral economics that find that these people wait and lose tons of money in investing, never really gather resources, that companies will spend $10,000 a year per employee lost by procrastination. There's health, social relationships. As a social psychologist, my interest has been, what impact does it have on our relationship with others? Procrastinators are not liked by other people. People don't like, even procs, I call them procs, don't like other procs. And where does this come from? Are we genetically born this way? Absolutely not. We're made this way. And where does it begin? In the family. And we find that fathers, not mothers, make people procrastinators. Well, what kind of dad? The cold, demanding, stern father, as long as you live under this roof, is more likely to produce children that are likely to grow up to become procrastinators.
Wow.
Because this is how they learn to cope. What if it's a single home? Well, we also find if the mother or, you know, single parent is also that cold, demanding person, this is the way the child learns to cope with life.
So
and they're not
liked
by other procs.
So, Joe, how does a parent train a kid to not be a procrastinator? What kind of setting do you need to give them to develop to not be a proc, as you call them.
Sure, you don't treat an 18-year-old like you treat an 8-year-old, and you don't treat a 28-year-old like an 18-year-old. And that's what we parents often do. They treat us the same. They're these cold, demanding, distant, unloving, inflexible. As children get older, you have to be flexible. You always love them. You never want people to hurt themselves. But sometimes we do have to let people learn to fail. That's one of the cures for procrastination. You have to let people stop bailing them out. Don't worry about the dishes piling up. So what if the car is stalled on the side of the road? They have to learn that life has consequences. Right? I'm not saying let them hurt themselves. I'm saying let them learn that there's consequences for our life and stop bailing them out. It's called interpersonal dependence. In psychology, they're very interpersonally dependent. They wait for others to do it for them. And then they'll say, but wait a minute, I was going to do that. Yeah, but you told me that 3 weeks ago. Someone had to pick the dining room table. We really needed the new car. The refrigerator had to be bought. All those kinds of things, you know. We really needed to go to this, see a movie. It was getting late. Yeah, you didn't like the one I chose, but someone had to make a decision. You know, so we have to let them experience life and stop bailing them out.
We're talking to Joe Ferrari right now, psychology professor at DePaul University and author of the book Still Procrastinating. So what's to be done about this, Joe? If we're made into procrastinators, maybe we know we've got a problem that sounds like us, but we don't know how to fix it because it
right.
seems almost insurmountable sometimes. Where do we start?
Okay, that's great, and everybody always wants the cures. But it's so important that we understand that these are not lazy people. To tell the chronic procrastinator, just do it, would be like saying to a clinically depressed person, cheer up. It's far more complicated, and that's not going to work. Now, if you're part of the 20 to 25%, let's be honest, you're going to need therapy. You need professional assistance because you've got to break the ways you think about it and the ways you act. It's not just a behavioral problem. It's not a time management issue. It's a perceptual thing. They're very concerned about what other people think about them. You see, if I never finish, I can never be judged by other people. I'd rather have other people think I lack effort than lacking ability, because lacking ability is far more detrimental to my image. So they put things off. So you've got to change and help reshape the way they think about the situation, and also learn new skills that allow them to finish. So if you're part of the 20%, you need therapy. The reason, Veronica, I wrote this book a number of years ago was I got tired of all the time management books that were out there and telling people, well, budget your time and learn to do this and break it down. And I kept getting calls and messages from people saying, this isn't working. There's more to it. What can you tell me as the international expert on this? And so that's why the title is called Still Procrastinating, because I'm trying to reach those people to say, you're still doing this with all these other approaches. Well, first of all, you're not alone. 20 to 25% is very high. So you're not alone. There's many people. And here's the profile that you fit. So I want people, your listeners, to learn, if you're a chronic proc, don't say, well, that's it, I'm doomed this way, it's in my genes, there's nothing I can do about it. Stop the excuse-making, stop the buts and the howevers, and learn to start doing things. Just do it now, to take the Nike quote and extend it.
So your starting point, it sounds like, in therapy, or maybe if we're not in that chronic group, just occasional procrastinators, it's still a mindset change. So what has
Absolutely.
To change in the procrastinator's mindset to take those first steps?
Well, okay, some of these books out there like to talk about different types of procrastination. The data really doesn't show this. And by the way, there's an international group that studies procrastination. We just met in Germany back in July. We meet every 2 years. We're hoping to do the next one in Chicago, so that's hot off the press. But anyway, what people are showing is that, this is not a time management. It has workplace implications, health implications, interpersonal relationships. If you're part of the 80% who may delay a task, well, step back and ask why. What's going on? What am I afraid of? This is all part of the way of rethinking. So what if I do it and it isn't 100%? A lot of procrastinators say, oh, I'm not a procrastinator. I'm a perfectionist. And until it's perfect, I don't want to hand it in. So I don't want to give it to you because it really isn't going to show my best work. Well, follow what clinicians call the 80% rule. If it's 80% done, if it's 80% accurate, that's good. If you want 85%, nothing is perfect. And don't use that as your excuse for not getting things done. Focus on getting most of it done. Notice I didn't say mediocrity. That's 50%. I'm saying, is most of it done? Is it vastly done? And if so, is this adequate for now?
I like that kind of thinking. We're talking about procrastination with Joe Ferrari. He's a psychology professor at DePaul University. He's authored the book, Still Procrastinating.
And you can join in with your questions and your experiences. Are you a chronic procrastinator, or is it someone close to you? How does it affect your life? Have you figured out how to get around your procrastinating tendencies and get things done sooner? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with psychology professor Joseph Ferrari from DePaul University. He's the author of the book Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done. He's sharing his research on why we procrastinate and what we can do about it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you procrastinate? Do you maybe need some advice? Have you figured out a way to not put things off? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers right away. Joan is with us in Campbellsport. Joan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great topic.
What do you want to bring up, Joan?
I'm the biggest procrastinator around, and I know I am, but according to my boyfriend, major procrastinator. But I honestly will wait till the very last minute until push comes to shove, and then I'll tackle my task. But I have to be up against the wall.
And have you tried to fix that, Joan? Try to do something about it?
I do. I mean, I think about it, which I think is part of procrastinating too, but I don't know. Hmm. You know what I mean? But it's like I just know I have to do something, and I just can't. It's like I'm frozen. I just can't do it until I'm in a push comes to shove situation.
All right, and Joe, I imagine you hear this all the time. What do you tell people in that boat?
Absolutely, and in fact, we published a study to see, because you hear about this from a lot of procs. They say I have to wait till the last minute to get going. It's the only way I can get going. You know, it jump starts me. So we did that. And Joan, what we found was, and I'm glad Rob asked you some follow ups about this, because you actually would do better. You would perform better. You would accomplish the task in more easily if you did it earlier. Now, this notion that I have to wait till the last minute to get going, actually, they failed. And we did this in experiments. This isn't just asking people. We actually brought them into the lab and put them under time limits and found that they do worse under the limited time. But they think they do better. So this waiting till the last minute to get myself going, getting the juices flowing, and I have to get motivated that way, is really not accurate and not true. Now, true, we don't always fail, and I'm sure the procs listening to this will jump on and say, oh, he doesn't know. I remember that time when I waited and I succeeded. And then you have to say, yeah, but that was 23 years ago, and look at all the failures since. So, Joan, you know, you're not going to do the best job by waiting to the last minute. That's really, you're fooling yourself. And don't worry about not making the best possible job you can do. Do the best you can, and that's all we can ask. It doesn't have to be 100%.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to go next to Wanda joining us from Sheboygan. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, yes. I have a problem with both sides. My son is a procrastinator. He's 23. My husband's always asking him to do stuff, and he can never get it done. So my husband is anal, so he just does it all the time, and then they fight. And it just drives me crazy. Do you have any solutions for that?
Great questions, Wanda. And Joe, what do you do when you've got conflicting personality styles going on?
Well, you notice what this sounds, what I said earlier. It sounds you've just given Wanda a life example of the situation I said before. Your husband's bailing him out. Procrastinators are interpersonally dependent. They let other people do things for them if they wait long enough. And your husband loses it and says, I can't wait anymore. This has to get done. That has to get done. And then he does it. And then they fight because your husband is angry. Your son's going to come back and probably say, but I told you that I was going to do that. And it goes on and on. And I don't know, wonder if this is your personal situation, but the data shows moms tend to be more indecisive, because the child will run to the parent and say, Mom, what am I supposed to do, Dad? And they'll say, well, I don't know, honey. He is your dad, and, you know, you should follow what he says. So you've got an interesting dynamic that sounds right up the alley. What can you do? Well, your husband's got to bite the bullet and let him fail. I'm sorry, he has to learn to fail. My Italian grandmother, Gwanda, had a saying, and it loses in the translation. For some people, they won't get out of the water till the they won't get off the beach till the water hits their behind. In other words, the tide is coming, and you can say to them, it's coming, you got to move. They won't move till they get wet. Your son's got to get wet, not drown. But your husband has to let the stuff on the beach get wet until your son says, hey, I got to move. All right? And some people have to know that. And you know who understands this, Rob and Wanda and Veronica? The 12-steppers. Because that's the model of the 12-step. You can't lead people to change. They have to bottom out. So Wanda, unfortunately, don't let him hurt himself, but your husband's got to let him get wet.
Wanda, good luck as we talk to Joe Ferrari about procrastination. He's a psychology professor at DePaul University. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234. George is with us in Fox Lake, Illinois. George, hi.
Hey, good topic. I'm also a therapist, and one of the things I noticed with folks who tend to prioritize is that there's a whether or not it's kind of capturing their life and making it difficult for them to move forward in areas compared to if they're just prioritizing. You know, I think a lot of times people prioritize, if we call it procrastination, but what they're really doing is saying what's important to them now, and they move forward in those areas and do what's important. Now, I think there's a difference between that and are you laying on the couch not doing anything productive in your life. But if you're replacing productivity in different areas, then I think it's prioritizing. And I just kind of want to know what your feelings on that as a psychology professor and what you sense in that area. And that's about it.
Joe, what do you think?
Thank you, George. A couple of quick comments. You're absolutely right, differentiating between prioritizing and procrastination. Look, if you've got a dozen things to do, obviously 10, 11, and 12 have to wait. Is that prioritizing? No. The true procrastinator makes that list of a dozen things, does one, maybe two, and then reshuffles the list and mixes it up and makes an extra copy of it and thinks about it and ponders about it. Well, that's procrastination. You're absolutely right. These are not the same thing. So listeners who are, George, your clients out there who are realizing that they prioritize, you're not procrastinating. You're effectively working on tasks. There's a guy these days who talks about structured procrastination. He's really talking about prioritizing, but it's a catchy concept. You see, the problem, George, is I don't want your clients to realize that there's excuse-making here. Well, then it's okay that I can procrastinate, because they're looking for that opportunity. If we give them the out of it's a good thing and it's a positive thing and it's okay to procrastinate, well, then they're going to procrastinate. But life is too short, and as you know, we have to capture the gusto of all that's out there. Leave a legacy. Don't procrastinate. You know, life is not about me. Life is about we, and procrastinators have to understand that.
All right. Thanks, George. Let's get in one more quick call. Rebecca joins us in Oconto Falls. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I actually trick myself, and my dad always says that I'm on Lombardi time because I'm a horrible procrastinator, but Lombardi said that if you're on time, you're late. So you're 15 minutes early for everything. So I actually trick myself that everything that I need done has a deadline, but I always put that deadline earlier. So if I get a party invitation and it's for 7 o'clock on my calendar, it goes for 6 p.m. Because
uh-huh.
then even if I, by chance I happen to be a little bit earlier, even though I'm always late for everything, I go around the block 2 times and then I'm on time.
That's smart, Rebecca. What about that, using some tricks like that to trick ourselves into being on time and getting things done?
Well, Rebecca, in other areas besides social events, do you procrastinate, or is it only when it comes to social events?
It's everything.
Okay, so if your boss said something has to get done, you procrastinate on that. Yes?
Everything, it's schoolwork, it's, you know, even like if something needs to be filled out by this date, but I always, you know, put something, you know, my boss always laughs at me. He goes, you're always early on everything. And I'm like, well,
And Joe, just about 30 seconds for a response.
Okay, because it doesn't sound like you're a chronic procrastinator. The chronic procrastinator, the trick of setting the clock won't work. They know they have the extra time. If you do it for them and you trick them, because I've worked with clients to do that, and they get really pissed. They don't like that. How dare you trick me? And now the element of trust. But if people who just procrastinate in one area of their life try to do that, that might work. And that's why I was trying to find that out, Rebecca. But if it works for you, super.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joe, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and thanks for calling. And if you want to follow up so I don't have to talk a mile a minute the next time, let me know. We can make a longer show.
All right. That was Joseph Ferrari, professor of psychology at DePaul University, author of the book Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done.
Reports of the death of the communal or family meal have been not totally exaggerated, as it turns out. According to a new report from the Food Marketing Institute, nearly half of all meals and snacks are now eaten alone.
As for breakfast and lunch in particular, most of us are eating them alone these days, if we're eating them at all. Yeah, some people are flat out skipping lunch. According to a 2012 report, we eat them at our desks or we just don't eat them.
Roberto Ferdman joins us now. He covers food and economics for the Washington Post Wonk blog. He recently wrote a piece on the rise of dining alone in America. Roberto, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, back in 1985, you report the New York Times said that it's no longer odd to dine alone. What are the latest numbers on that today?
Isn't that funny, considering how we eat today? The numbers, you kind of pointed to them. This is the most recent in what's really a series of research on eating alone, the instances in which people alone or the frequency with which people eat alone. This particular one found that more than half of all eating opportunities are had alone. So snacks at your desk or snacks on the go, breakfast at home or on the go, lunch and dinner. But others kind of support this exact notion. In fact, the U.S. Time Use Service shows that the majority of Americans report regularly eating alone. And these numbers have all increased dramatically over the past few decades and are seen by experts within or market industry analysts as only rising going forward. The headline of this piece was the most American thing there is, eating alone. And that's not because you're American if you eat alone, or that there aren't other things like, I don't know, hanging a flag outside of your house that might not be more American. But eating alone is really at the center. It's at the intersection of all these different happenings, these trends in the United States that have to do with a lot more than just food.
Right. Part of the story here is that a lot of us, more of us, are living alone, too.
If you look back to the 1960s, something like 13% of all households had a single occupant. In the 1970s, it rose almost to 20%. But today, that number is almost like 30%. So close to a third of all households have a single occupant, meaning that you're eating alone if you're at home in 30% of households. So that has had a huge effect on the number of people that eat alone and the number of times that people eat alone. Part of what's driven the rise of single households is the fact that we're no longer getting married as quickly as we used to. Something like 1 in 5 25-year-olds have never been married. That number is significantly higher than it used to be. People aren't really getting married until into their 30s today, which means that through their 20s, they're either living with roommates or they're living by themselves. And because of both of these things, they're eating a lot of meals by themselves.
And for the people that do live with someone else, be it a family member or a roommate, is dinner sort of the last holdout?
So if you look at, I've actually written about the family supper and the rise or fall of it, and it's held fairly steady. This particular study found that something like 67%, or roughly two-thirds of all dinners are had with company, so with other people. That doesn't mean they're had with family. It could be had with a friend, had with a roommate that isn't family. But what this shows is that dinner is in some ways more sacred than the other meals. But I think that has to do with the fact that we're very busy and we're very busy leading up until dinner. Dinner is kind of the one time that we can sit down with others and have a meal that we aren't rushed or aren't skipping, as you mentioned before.
And
so that's
I'm sorry, Roberto. I was going to say part of the story of being busy is that a lot of us are eating lunch at our desks at work. Veronica and I eat lunch at our desks often in the same office. So I don't know if we're technically eating alone or not, but we're not alone in that. This is getting more and more common, isn't it, Roberto?
It's far more common. It's something like 60% of lunches or 65% of lunches, I forget the precise number, but are now either had at your desk or not had at all. So you're right to point out that people are eating at their desks, which is kind of sad. There's a reason why people refer to like sad desk lunches or sad desk salads. In fact, there's even a little bit discussion around like what's okay to eat at your desk. And the fact that we're even talking about that shows how common the practice is. But it's also that people are skipping these meals. We don't have time for them.
That seems unusual to me. I mean, maybe I'm late to the party here, but it seems as though people don't usually skip lunch. They skip breakfast. So what does it say about our society that we're too crunched to even eat lunch at all?
Well, this is actually something that's become more and more common. It's not that we aren't eating between breakfast and dinner. It's that we might be replacing lunch with two smaller snacks. I would say smaller meals, but which are effectively snacks at different points in the day. So you might have a banana, a fruit, or some sort of food to keep you going, and then have something else in between what would be your lunch, but the lunch that you're not having, and dinner. Breakfast, however, is actually the meal that people skip most often. I think that people are just too pressed for time. And most recently, we've seen that some of the research around the importance of eating breakfast in terms of what it does for our health is kind of under fire. So who's to say that the people who aren't eating breakfast aren't somehow healthier for skipping the meal?
Talking to Roberto Ferdman with the Washington Post about his recent piece on eating alone in the United States. Most of us are doing it. We're doing it more. We're eating lunch at our desk. We're eating home alone. Some of us are just skipping meals altogether. You can let us know your experience at 800-642-1234. Do you eat many meals alone? Or do you go out of your way to make sure you eat at least some of them with other people? Do you see a backlash either starting now, Roberto, or maybe in the future where people are saying, hey, this is terrible. We need to start eating together again.
I mean, in terms of a movement, there isn't a comprehensive movement to overcome this. I don't, and basically everyone I've spoken to agrees that this is pretty much headed in one direction. It's the direction in which we eat alone more often than not, and people will continue to replace certain meals, not necessarily the same exact meal every day, but for snacks because we don't have a lot of time. And you know, this is playing out in all sorts of interesting ways. For instance, within the fast food sector, for which breakfast has become really, really important. You see McDonald's extending its breakfast throughout the entire day. You saw Taco Bell, last year beginning to sell breakfast and really focusing on things that are portable because people basically won't buy things that aren't portable. And that really speaks to how important it is to eat these days. It's basically something that we need to do throughout the course of our busy days, but don't sit down and take the time to enjoy.
Now, you said this is a phenomenon that's at the nexus of a bunch of things that are going on in American culture, like marrying later and living alone longer. Are there similar trends, though, going on in other countries, or is the U.S. Sort of the forerunner on this one?
This is something that's happening elsewhere as well. The pushing back, basically, of marriage is not just happening in the United States, though it's happening in the United States a little bit more drastically than it is elsewhere. And the crunch, the time crunch is happening elsewhere as well. So if you look, for instance, to Europe, this is the sort of thing that's being noticed as well. But America as it is, or the United States as it has been for other things, is kind of leading the pack in this trend of eating alone, but it's more of a stigma, or it was more of a stigma in the United States than it has been elsewhere. So I think that's why it feels more significant. Even anecdotally, for me, I think about the instances in which I began to eat alone and how it's become normalized over time. I was overcoming, the kind of the social stigma attached to it, which is part of why I brought up that 1985 article. Clearly, they're talking about eating alone and how it's becoming okay, because a lot of people fear that it's not.
Well, and you even write that restaurants are starting to accommodate some solo diners in different ways. Can you tell us about that?
So the traditional way to accommodate solo diners is to house them at the bar. And there are instances in which restaurants have actually broadened the number of seats that they have at bars. But then there are also restaurants which have just incorporated bench-like seating. Jose Andres in Washington, D.C. Is one whose new restaurant, in fact, caters exactly to that. He has bench-like seating so that people can come and sit as they come and go on their own. Long tables that don't seat a particular number of people are another perfect example. Bench-like tables or where diners can sit with people that they don't know. There are really many different ways to accommodate them. There's even a bit of a philosophy around the comfort of eating alone that involves only sitting one placemat or one place setting at a two-person table so that when someone sits down, you don't have to take away the second place place setting, which, it's kind of a funny thing. I agree. But at the same time, it might have a kind of significant philosophical impact on how you feel about sitting down, because you're sitting down to a table that's for one person instead of a table that was for two. But sadly, you couldn't convince someone else to come eat with you.
We're talking with Washington Post reporter Roberto Ferdman about the rise of dining alone at home or out or at work here in the United States.
And you can join us. Does this sound a bit like what's going on in your life? Maybe breakfast and lunch alone, maybe skipped altogether. Do you feel okay eating by yourself in a restaurant? Is it something you're comfortable with, maybe that you didn't used to be? What is that experience like for you now? And do you think we're losing out on anything by eating alone? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Washington Post reporter Roberto Ferdman about the rise of dining alone in America.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like your life? Are you eating more meals alone, whether at home, at your desk, at work, at a restaurant, or maybe just breakfast and lunch alone? Or do you skip those, as more and more people are doing? Do you wish you had meals with other people more often than you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We've got Anne on the line in Wauwatosa. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm 51 years old. I'm a very social person, but I love eating alone because at a moment's notice, I can go to any restaurant I want, even a restaurant that I just want to try out. I like sitting at the bar, but, sometimes I bring a book and I just want to sit and read. I just think of all the spectacular meals I would have missed out on if I had to, wait for somebody to, go with me. And so I love going by myself.
Have you always felt that comfortable doing it, Anne, or did you have to build up to it and now you're comfortable?
No, you know what? I've always felt comfortable doing it. I like to go to movies by myself because if it's really bad, you can just get up and go. You don't have to have a consensus.
Good point.
And I have a lot of friends who, I don't like that kind of food. And I don't, I can go and try because I love all different kinds of food. So, and I have met some wonderful people because you're sitting there alone. You're kind of a target. Hey, what are you doing? People talk to you. What are you reading? That kind of thing.
Anne, that's terrific. Thank you so much for sharing your experience about that. She feels very empowered by doing it, and she's stressing there the freedom of choosing where you want to go, when you want to go. Definite perks, don't you think, Roberto?
I kind of had the urge to clap on air, but I held myself back. No, I think it's actually very astute of her, and a lot of people don't realize that the distinction that they're making when they decide to not do something by themselves. Eating out is a perfect example, but people tend to weigh doing something on their own with doing it with someone else, when in reality, if you're sitting alone at home on a Friday night, you're making the decision between doing the thing and not doing the thing, both of those things being done alone. So I think it's fantastic that she likes to go out and eat and go to movies alone. I feel exactly the same way.
And Anne mentioned sometimes she does this with a book, and that's important to me if I'm dining out alone, or actually eating at home alone, for that matter. I want something to do. I want something to keep me occupied. I got to have a book or something, maybe a tablet in front of me. Is that a trend we're seeing more out in public?
That's very much a trend, so much so that there are restaurants that are either accommodating people who come in not just with books but with tablets and I guess the larger iPhones, essentially Apple products, which Apple, I'm sure, loves. I think that both speaks to the growing acceptance of the trend, but then also in kind of a weird, perverse way, the fact that there's still a stigma around eating alone, because part of that is occupying yourself. But I think often, and I hope I'm not just projecting, but maybe I am projecting, part of that is also bringing something and putting it next to you so people know that,
oh, yeah,
yes, you are alone, but you're also with this book.
Right. If you're just sitting there, you're just a guy sitting there. If there's a book, it's like, oh, that guy's doing a thing. So, yeah, no, that's me too, Roberto,
see,
for sure.
See, but isn't there something wrong with that we feel we need to use books and smartphones as sort of armor for dining out alone,
yes,
where someone like Anne can just, it sounds like, just go and sit there and be comfortable?
Yeah. More power to Anne.
More power to Anne. I think there's definitely something wrong with it, but that doesn't mean I don't still do it.
As do most people, I betcha. Well, we're talking right now to Washington Post's Roberto Ferdman about the rise of dining alone in America. Nearly half of all meals and snacks are now eaten alone. And we want to know if you find this in your life at 800-642-1234. How comfortable are you with dining alone? What do you think about this trend? And we'll go next to Anna in Anisac, Illinois. Hi there, Anna.
Hi there. You guys are actually leaning right into my next comment. Is since with social media, I feel like people don't necessarily feel like they're eating alone when they go out. People usually post where they're at, what they're doing. So just because people are out supposedly eating by themselves, maybe they don't actually feel like they're alone or by themselves. Hmm.
Right, and that's a relatively new thing. Thanks for bringing that up, Anna. That you mean that you may be physically alone at a table in a room, but you don't feel alone. So maybe that's the difference in comfort, Roberto.
Well, what's funny about that is that there's actually something in sociology. There's actually a name for it that's evading me at the moment. But what it centers around is the idea that we are kind of at the center of our own movie. We're the main character in our own movie, but we're not the main character in other people's movies. So what that means is when we go to a restaurant and we're sitting by ourselves, we're sitting there playing on our phones thinking, you know, my God, everyone's noticing that I'm here alone. But the truth is that people don't actually notice that you're there alone. They might notice it in passing, but no one is sitting there worrying about, you know, me who's there with my book that's sitting flat on the table.
Anna, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Judy in Appleton next. Judy, hi.
Hi. I have a question as to whether other people have the same problem that I have with walking into a restaurant and requesting a table for just one. I always, even if I think about it ahead of time, find myself saying just one or only one, instead of assertively saying one, which is what I would say if there were two or three.
Do you feel like it's almost an apology, Judy? Oh, only one.
Yes.
Yeah. Judy, thanks so much. Thanks for calling in. Roberto, there's still, probably in public or in private, we feel a little like we're letting somebody down if we're eating by ourselves.
I appreciate that comment. I actually haven't given that any thought, but I'm pretty sure that every time I've eaten alone, I've said just one. So I'll never say that and not think about it from here on out.
I was trying to mentally do it in my head, and I think she's right. You would always want to put something before the number one, something to practice there. And we're going to go next to Jen. Jen joins us in Vernon. Jen, hi.
Hi. I was just thinking that most people, when they do choose to eat with other people, are typically on their smartphones, their tablets, and they're not interacting with the other people. So it's pretty much the same thing as eating by themselves.
Ah, you're flipping that around a little and looking at the phenomenon of being alone together with other people, which is worse or better, I guess. So what do you think about that quandary, Roberto?
That's an interesting. First of all, I'm curious to know where you're eating out, because while I see people eating, sitting at tables, playing on their phones, I don't know if the majority of people around the table are. But actually, there's a bit of an annoyance with this habit, to the point where there are restaurants in both D.C. and New York, kind of where I shift back and forth from, that force force patrons to put away their phones or even to give in their phones when they show it when they first arrive at the restaurant. So they're addressing that very problem, forcing people to be present, not just with the, you know, not just with their food, but also with the people at their table. It annoys me. It's, you know, I grew up in a household. When I was young, we didn't have tablets and phones and stuff. But I still, when I go home to dinner, bringing out your cell phone is not okay.
Jen, thanks for the call. Roberto, briefly, as we wrap up, doing this, looking at this research, is this motivating you personally to try to eat more meals with other people, in or out?
I actually think that my takeaway from this is to embrace eating alone, to understand that it's actually not some, it's only something that is bizarre historically or traditionally here in the United States, and is something that's accepted elsewhere in Europe in particular. I've had actually the complete opposite reaction to that. I want to embrace eating out in the same way that I want to embrace going to the movies alone, as one of the callers said, and doing other things alone, because they're okay.
It's a fantastic place to leave it. Roberto, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
That was Roberto Ferdman, reporter covering food and economics for Washington Post's Wonk Blog. He joined us to talk about the rise of solo dining in the United States.